Hey everybody, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. My name's Mike Gibb. I run AccountRecovery.net, and I want to welcome you to today's webinar where we're talking about how to make sure collector training sticks. Training a collector is one thing. Getting that collector to remember their training is an entirely different kettle of fish. Many would argue that the remembering part is the most important component of collector training. So today, in this webinar, which is being sponsored by Peak Revenue Learning, we've got a panel of experts here to share their insights into how to make sure what you teach collectors sticks with them when they are engaging with consumers. As I mentioned, this webinar is being sponsored by Peak Revenue Learning. Peak Revenue Learning's Knowledge Source is a training platform that helps companies address the biggest challenge in learning and knowledge retention globally. It's called the forgetting curve. If you haven't heard of the forgetting curve, or if you forgot about it, you've no doubt seen the results in your organization. The forgetting curve describes the rapid, dramatic deterioration of retained knowledge after learning events, whether that is new hire or other types of training. And all your people experience this, regardless of whether they are new or seasoned team members. The results are mistakes and complaints, missed revenue and dissatisfaction, rework, and higher turnover. This leads to increased regulatory, financial, contractual, and reputational risk. Knowledge Source will turn the forgetting curve into deep learning, enabling your team to rapidly acquire the crucial skills and knowledge, and more importantly, help them retain it. Knowledge Source will help make your job easier and empower your people with the knowledge they need to thrive. You can learn more at peakrevenuelearning.com. We're also going to hear from Chris Rickman from Peak Revenue Learning a little later in our webinar. All right, if you've been with us at all this week, you've no doubt seen that I'm changing up this part of the introduction. I'm not reading bios anymore. We're getting more into sort of more engaging dialogue right off the beginning. So I'm going to introduce a speaker, and then I'm asking them this question. And you can't see that. The question is, would you rather be famous for singing, being an athlete, or for acting? Dennis Barton is the owner of the Barton Law Group, which is the collection firm for Missouri and Illinois. Dennis, which one would you rather be famous for?
Singer, songwriter.
Why Easy. Is that?
I play, I sing, I songwrite.
It's an extension of what you do already. I love it. All right. Excellent. Thank you. Sharika Newman is a corporate trainer at Revco Solutions. Sharika, would you be rather famous for singing, sports, or acting?
I would choose singing, not that I'm piggybacking off of Dennis, but singing because it makes me feel deeply connected to myself and other people. There's something about using your voice that bypasses logic and goes straight to the emotion. So there you have it.
Love it. Great answer. Thank you. Jennifer
That's
Beck,
a way better answer than mine.
Jennifer is the training and operations coordinator for first and third party collections at the Stark Agency. Jennifer, which one do you want to be famous for?
I would be famous for sports because I've always loved playing sports and the strategy of sports and the work that goes into sports. Not that work doesn't go into singing and acting as well, but yeah, that's what I would be famous for.
Excellent. Thank you. Love that. David Lee Richardson serves as the head of organizational leadership development at Harris & Harris. David Lee, which one's your preference?
Man, I'm going to go with sports, and particularly during that era when Dr. J played, you know. The first Airwalker. So I would want to be famous for sports, particularly during that era, because I think he was one of the greatest basketball players ever.
Excellent. Love that. Thank you all for sharing right off the bat. Everybody, all of you who are watching us live today, you're absolutely invited to engage and ask questions and submit comments during the course of our webinar. You can use the chat or the Q&A. The benefit of using the Q&A, it does have an anonymous option. So if you want to submit questions or comments anonymously, you can do that through the Q&A. All right, let's jump into our conversation. So,
Mike, I think you forgot Chris.
Did I? Should I ask Chris? There it is. Chris from Peak Revenue Learning, before you go backstage and hide for it until we bring you back in, what do you want to be famous for?
Sports, definitely.
Sports, definitely. Why?
It's just it's just amazing that people have the skills that they can do to be so graceful. I mean, it's what we were made to do is to move.
Love that. Great answer. Thanks. Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks for reminding me to ask Chris, and thank you everybody for your answers. So let's jump into our conversation now. What are the most common reasons that collector training fails to translate into lasting on the job behavior? We're talking about making collector training stick. So let's talk about the reasons why it might not. Jennifer, I'll ask you to kick us off.
The most common reason, I think, is because the behaviors and the processes that are taught over training, they're not always translated into the bigger picture of what they're trying to accomplish and like the mission statement of the company. So when you're going through training, you're modeling things, you're expecting them to model things back to you. You're not at the end, not always at the end of the conversations tying it into, look, we just helped that member complete this. You know, I work for mainly first party collections, so we represent a lot of credit unions directly. And so when we are talking to members, they don't know that they're necessarily talking to a collection agency. They think they're talking to just another department within their credit union. So they expect a certain level of standard and service. And that is the main objective when we have on our calls. We're not always looking towards payments. We're looking towards understanding why the member fell behind, how to keep them from getting that way in the future. And then we're tying that into payment arrangements and payment plans and things like that. And so when I'm training somebody and I'm training them on how to take payments, how to talk on the phones, what scripts to use, I'm also at the end tying that back into this is how we're helping the member and this is how we're helping our clients. And that's how we're getting that information to stick and helping them to make decisions based off of that.
Awesome. Good answer, Jennifer. So for me, training fails to translate into lasting job behavior or on the job behavior is when it's too theoretical or too dense. You know, there's like a disconnection from the real call reality, right? So if collectors don't practice exactly what they do on the floor, and it doesn't get reinforced immediately afterwards, the behavior will never become automatic. And you continue to coach and coach and coach and coach, and you know, bad behaviors can slip in.
You know, I want to add to this because I'm going to answer this from more of a practical standpoint, mm-hmm. right? So if we go to the actual classroom, I think that sometimes the training breaks down within the classroom because there's no visibility into the actual classroom, right? Whether it is a physical on-site class or whether it's a virtual class. And within a training construct, we have layers of oversight. And so if a training manager or a training director is actively engaged in observing the delivery of the class, right? Like what the heck is really taking place in the classroom? Because we have all these different trainers, you know, with different skill sets and delivery methodologies and how they're giving that information. But from a management standpoint, from a director or from a manager, maybe even a supervisor, or maybe even a subject matter expert from the ops team that's ultimately going to inherit this training team, this training class, I think it's important to have direct oversight and see what's actually taking place in the class. How's mm-hmm. the information being delivered? How's that class being managed? And so traditional coaching, one-on-one coaching, that if the supervisor or the manager doesn't have the opportunity to pull that trainer for coaching outside of the classroom, at least they could develop a program where they could provide feedback and oversight during the actual delivery of the class so that when that class is done, the information that they're providing about how that class went is very relevant. It's very relevant because it's relevant to eyes on observation. It's relevant to what I've heard, what I've seen, what I felt during that actual classroom delivery. And so if there's no real oversight, if there's no insight into what's happening in the classroom, we really don't have a measurement to determine how effective the actual delivery was. And we have trainers who are phenomenal, and then we have trainers who are still being developed. And what can aid the trainer in being more effective in their delivery is a supervisor that observes that delivery and provides them real-time feedback on what their strengths, what their opportunities are, so that they can be more effective to continue to grow as content delivery.
Maybe kind of building on what David's saying, and pardon me if this is just a rephrasing, but you know, we're talking about making sure it sticks. We got to make sure it was there in the first place. And so with those measurables, we got to, you know, make sure they understand just from the jump, because something they don't understand is definitely not going to stick. So David makes a great point on observing and measuring to make sure that it got in the head in the first place, so in order to allow it to remain there.
I love both of those points. I love David Lee mentioning getting feedback from the supervisor in real time. I think a huge part of completing training is also getting feedback from your trainees immediately while it's still fresh and with the perspective in their minds that they're getting ready to be independent and they have certain expectations of themselves now. So I love to send out like post-training surveys to my team. Understand, and then to Dennis's point, what didn't stick? What can we do better? What do you still think you need to be successful when you're going to be independent? Is there anything that's still fuzzy to you? And then we also achieve that long term as well by making sure we check in with them once a month at least and have one-to-one meetings, and then as a group regularly as well.
I
Jennifer, I have a question about that. You said you give them a, for I may get this phrasing wrong, a post-trial, like a questionnaire or survey or something. Here's what, when I ask somebody, I'll explain something and I'll say, okay, now tell me what I just said. And if they're like, well, I mean, I get it. I can't get the words down. That means you don't understand it. If you can't explain it back, you don't understand something. As a parent of a 10 and 13-year-old, I have that conversation quite a bit. And I mean, not that my kids are stupid, but they're all,
I have twin 13-year-old boys, and I hear you. I hear you. They're not stupid, but they act like it.
I don't know. What'd you do all day? I don't know. It's terrible. Anyway, so with your post-trading surveys or questions or whatever, how in-depth do you go into that? Like, what does that entail?
So it's about 10 questions. And I mean, I could pull it up, but I'm asking, what can I do better? How would you rate like the systems used or how do you know where to look things up if you need help? What do you still need? Is there anything that you still need? Things like that.
Do you
And
ever
I
ask
make
about
every
your...
question required so that there's no skipping out, and I make it nothing is like multiple choice, nothing's like yes or no, it's all text boxes. I want to hear from you.
Do they rate the training itself? Like, how good a job did your trainer do?
Again, I try to stay away from like the give me a number on 1 to 10, yes or no, like closed-ended questions. All of my questions are text box questions. All of them are required, but I do say, how do you feel your trainer did? Where is an area your trainer can improve? And then as well as the training systems and then our internal operation systems.
Yeah, Dennis, to Jennifer's point, there are, Kirkpatrick has four different levels of how we evaluate training. And that first level was what we in the industry call an L1 training evaluation. It's a level one training evaluation. And it's just the immediate reaction, right? And so for training organizations, for anyone that's listening to this, if you're trying to figure out how effective the training is, the absolute first step to evaluating the effectiveness of that training is exactly what Jennifer is talking about. We have to be proactive in getting that initial reaction, right? Because that's what L1 is, it's the initial reaction. And, there may be some differences in the types of questions that are asked from one evaluation to the next, but the four pieces that Jennifer talked about are kind of staples, right? You evaluate the trainer. Does the trainer have some opportunity for improvement? And we're getting that information from the people who sat through the actual class. We evaluate the curriculum. Is the curriculum up to par? So maybe the company has, I don't know, maybe you have some instructional designers, maybe you have content developers, or maybe you're a one-stop shop where the trainer does it all, right? They design it, develop it, and deliver it and evaluate it. I don't know. But that L1 evaluation is important so that we get the initial reaction, because it's tough to evaluate the effectiveness of a thing if you're asking those kinds of questions 3, 4, 5 weeks later when, no one can really remember what was said or what was done. So that L1 evaluation immediately after is important. Then the question then becomes, I guess, is how do you actually drive participation, right? Engagement with that actual evaluation. And one of the things that we do with our company is we hardwire that right into the curriculum. So it just becomes a module. If you're fortunate to be able to use an LMS, you can include that L1 evaluation in an actual module. The problem with that is sometimes you lose some of the transparency because that evaluation is assigned to an individual. Well, a workaround for that is SurveyMonkey. SurveyMonkey, you can make it completely anonymous and you can get real honest feedback on what exactly happened in that training.
I like that. So I would say here at RevCo, we do a 7-day survey as well as a 60-day survey. 7 days is because you've been in training for 7 days, 60 days because you've actually been on the job for 60 days. So we want to know how you're doing and how you're feeling then. Just recently, one of our corporate trainers, Jessica, she implemented a everyday survey, as you were talking about, David Lee, and it's an anonymous survey that goes out the last 10 minutes of the class, and she did it for one of our merge classes. And we found that to be very, very helpful because it asked questions about the agenda items, everything that we went over for that day, and asking them how do they feel about it? Is there anything they want to learn more about it? And based off of that survey, she compiles everything together. And then the next morning for review, that is exactly what we're going over to make sure we're going to hit every point that somebody mentioned to make sure that everyone has a better understanding of that agenda item that we went over. So that is something I will start implementing within my class to do it every day, not only on the 7 and 60 day.
That's nice. You know, at the end of the day,
Go.
It's all good.
I wanted to add to your comment, David Lee, where you said the initial reaction, it translated to me like being a collector on the phones and establishing that initial relationship and getting that initial reaction from a debtor or a member on the phone. You know, you have to build that foundation and you have to build rapport and you have to build that trust and that respect. I think that part of it goes a long way to making sure the trainee and the information that you teach them stick. You know, not only are they ready to go, but they want to serve. You know, they want to make sure that they're ready to go. They want to know that if something happens, I can pivot and I don't need to stick my head in the sand, or, you know, I actually want to do my best and give maybe my 110%. And that is a huge part of making sure training sticks, is to have that relationship and that foundation, that respect and that trust.
Yeah, I mean, those are all components of credibility, right? When you talk about measuring the effectiveness of the training and, you know, what are some of the reasons why maybe it falls apart and it doesn't translate to, you know, real world execution out on the job. You know, it's important if we're talking about setting a trainer up for success, it's very difficult for a trainer to overcome the credibility question that resides in the minds of new hires, because a lot of classes, new hires, they're just kind of seeing, okay, let me see what you got. Teach me something, you know, and you have to establish that rapport. You have to build that credibility. You have to be seen and viewed as someone who is knowledgeable about the subject that you're teaching, right? And if that isn't present, then, you know, you could have very good content, but you have learners who are in a very different headspace in terms of how they're receiving that content. So when the trainer has good established credibility by showing up for that class 30 minutes before the class even starts and own that room, maybe if it's a virtual class, you show up 15 minutes and you own it. You're on camera, you got music playing, you're ready. Right? When they get there, you're already there. Hey, how you doing? That kind of builds them to add in that credibility, you know, just kind of managing that whole online experience or that classroom experience, dealing with those things that individuals may consider to be, you know, favoritism, right? You spoke with this one about being late. You spoke with me about being late, but you didn't say anything to this one about being late. So as far as I'm concerned, you can't say anything to me because you didn't say anything to them. Credibility, building that trust, right? All of those little kinds of things can erode an individual's ability to really be engaged during, you know, during the training interaction. But I just want to, you know, double back on this feedback piece, because, Jennifer mentioned about the evaluation, you know, and when we talk about, you know, how employees rely on that feedback in order to be effective in the jobs that they do, there was a research that was done that says that about 85% of employees rely on feedback. They rely on feedback in order to perform their jobs well. And so we all need it, right? The trainer needs it. The employee needs it. So if we're training someone and we're evaluating them and observing how they perform their jobs, it's important to provide them with feedback so that they can have insight from someone who's, you know, really vested in their success on how they could do better. So we want to be sure that we're incorporating feedback elements, particularly that L1. And there are four different levels of feedback, four different levels of evaluating training effectiveness. But that L1 evaluation is vital, you know, because it gives the trainer, it gives the training organization the feedback that we crave in order to do our jobs better.
So I've got a question for the three of you. I think you're from,
Hold on, Dennis. Can ask your question. I want you to ask your question. But first, I did just want to hit the pause button really briefly on the conversation. I wanted to invite Chris Rickman from Peak Revenue Learning, which is sponsoring today's webinar, to say a few words. Chris.
Thank you, Mike. And hey, everyone. Grateful for the opportunity to sponsor today's webinar. Our company provides a knowledge source. It's the leading knowledge, skills, and compliance training platform for companies with collection operations. Knowledge Source is used by our clients to simplify and to lower the cost of training. That's whether that's new or existing employees, whether they're on-site or remote. Mentioned earlier was the phenomena that impacts any company training anyone, and that's the forgetting curve. What it does is it just describes what happens, and it's pretty dramatic. It's the rapid, dramatic deterioration of retained knowledge after any training or learning event. That could be a new hire training, or it could be other types of training. In addition to this leading to increased mistakes and complaints, it leads to missed revenue and dissatisfaction, and definitely contributes to greater turnover. A problem that many organizations share is considering employee development an expense rather than an investment. This view can have a real detrimental impact on morale, motivation, and retention. According to a study, there are employees that feel they are not being developed by their company to help reach their career goals are 12 times more likely to leave their company. Most of the people we speak to recognize that the model of onboarding training followed by annual refresher training is absolutely inferior to a model where spaced, repetitive micro-learning promotes much deeper learning. So knowledge source clients are companies that want to build and maintain a high level of assurance that their team members have mastered and are maintaining that mastery of the knowledge and skills expected of them when they're interacting with consumers. Knowledge source will increase quality, decrease risk, help grow revenue, lower your costs, and help reduce turnover. I invite you to find out more about us to visit peakrevenuelearning.com or give me a call. I'm at 803-521-0031. And we're here to help make your job easier and both you and your company more successful. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you, Chris. And thanks again to Peak Revenue Learning for sponsoring today's webinar. Sorry, Dennis, go ahead. I interrupted before. Please ask your question.
That's great. Yeah. Thanks for the, Chris. Thanks for the, for sponsoring. Okay. You know, I'm a little presumption here on your company sizes here, but I think you're a little larger than maybe some of a lot of agencies who are sometimes 10 or fewer employees. They don't have the resources for a specific trainer. They probably struggle with just getting the bare minimum of having somebody work along somebody else to you know, job shadow, and that turns out to be the training. So when there's limited resources like that, how do we take some of the great recommendations you've given so far and maybe fit it into the limited box of limited resources?
Well, I mean, the agent has someone to report to, right? It doesn't, I mean, if you're, so you're saying the person they're reporting to is the person running the company, or it's someone immediately under them, possibly?
Or, I'm a collector and I'm not a trainer, but this person came in as a new collector because we needed one, and now I'm going to train this new person. I wasn't hired as a trainer, and I think this happens more than anything else in our industry, probably in a lot of other businesses too, because my company doesn't have a designated trainer. I'm thankful that I have training in that. I have training in how to train, but I'm not a trainer either. So, because I'm a lawyer, I do my lawyer thing. Anyway, so that's kind of what I'm talking about. When it's people who are having to train and who are not trainers, and because I think SurveyMonkey and those sort of things and evaluations, even smaller companies can do that, which are great examples. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, I'm just curious on your insights on when smaller companies have the rubber to the road, situation where they're having non-trainers train trainers, and how we best deal with that.
I think that's a great way to learn is to see somebody who's right in it, doing their thing and demonstrating their knowledge. And hopefully you got somebody that's doing the right things. But either way, sometimes seeing somebody do the wrong things is fine as well because it's a good teacher as long as you're correcting that. It just makes that feedback piece 10 times more important. If you don't have a trainer that can get that feedback immediately and act on it with that experience, you need to be able to have a longer conversation at the end of this new person sitting with this not so training trainer. And you need to be able to understand, what did you learn? Demonstrate that for me. We're going to talk about why that's correct and why that's not. And this is why it's correct, and this is why it's not, because it's translating into helping these people, and it's translating into our mission statement. Right away before they're sitting with that person, I would recommend making sure that they get their compliance training and their compliance knowledge from somewhere trusted, like an ACA source, to make sure that they have the basics and they know, hey, this person isn't doing this right, as long as it's compliance related. Just yeah, making sure that after you're making them sit with you're having this not trainer sit with this person, understanding if are there any disconnects from how it should be done versus how they're doing it. Is this person learning anything, or is there maybe another person they can sit with? Yeah, sometimes training is expedited when you're doing it that way because you're learning the basics, and then you're saying, you need to have this confidence to be able to put this into play right away. And then you need to have even more open feedback and conversations and auditing and things like that.
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I love that answer that Jennifer gave because it's very practical, right? It's where the rubber meets the road and the execution, right? So sometimes that trainer may have to reach out for additional support and resources like an ACA, right? In order to get upskilled and be more effective at what they do. But as I understand the question, Dennis, this question is more of a resource issue, right? And so regardless of the size of the business, every business should be taking a look at what are those things that we deploy in order to make us more profitable. And I will tell you that if you have an organization and there's any amount, if you're, that organization is responsible for delivering any amount of training, you should have a training department that has a seat at the table during those discussions where you're talking about moving the business forward. I believe it was Jennifer that mentioned earlier, or Shrika that mentioned earlier, talking about how we should be talking about the vision, right? And tying that back to the overall organization as we're delivering the training. Well, it's difficult to do that if training doesn't have a seat at the table to fully understand the business objectives. Like, what are we driving at? What are those key metrics that our company is driving at this year? And a CFO or COOs should be taking a look at the budget and determining if we have enough resources in order to properly train the individuals who are going to be touching our customers. And if the answer comes back no, find the money. And I know that sometimes that's easier said than done, but if we understand that training is the lever that an organization pulls in order to drive performance, whether that training is leadership training, whether it's management training, you're talking about training supervisors on how to be effective with coaching, or if it's frontline training where we're training them on, you know, how to operate and navigate different billing systems, the company has to take, I believe, the company has to take a serious look at the resources that we're providing individuals within the company to be effective at delivering training that helps us accomplish the company's objective. Because if that isn't in place, it really isn't fair to put someone in a classroom who's undertrained, underskilled, and maybe they're a subject matter expert, but they don't really have an understanding of adult learning principles, right? Because that's a particular skill set. And they're training individuals, and as far as they're concerned, the training went well, but as far as the numbers are concerned, the training isn't giving us the return on the investment. So we put individuals through 40 hours worth of training. What did we get out of it, right? So if we look at training from a business standpoint, training should be giving us some sort of return, since it's not a profit center, right? It's a cost center. It's going to cost us to put these people through this class. Well, at the end of the day, when we evaluate its effectiveness, what did we get out of it? And so it's difficult to expect a return from an area where you make no investment, right? So we should be looking at that and providing our trainers or the training department what it needs in order to be effective at helping us as a business to move the business forward. And I don't have to tell you, Dennis, you know, you got individuals who are responsible for things like compliance. How much does that cost us if we end up sued because someone, you know, didn't read a mini Miranda or said the wrong thing to a customer, provided the inaccurate information regarding, credit, right? It's going to cost us dearly on the back end. So to ensure that we have individuals who know exactly what they're doing, how to handle those kinds of situations within a classroom and investing in them and making sure that that training department has a seat at the table, is it's vital for overall business success.
I agree with you, David Lee. So I would say if you don't have the resources to actually train your new hires or a new hire, REFCO is in the business of doing mergers now. So come see us. But no, just joking. But for real, to answer Dennis's question, I think it happens with collection agencies more often than not. We have that to happen across the board, right? I would say making sure that, you know, you have someone for them to sit with, to shadow with. You know, we do shadowing sessions. Making sure that you're going over the basics like Jennifer stated, ensuring that compliance is that number one thing that is actually trained on in the beginning. Hitting on those and making sure that you're having those one-on-ones and you're checking in with your agent to see how they're doing. Because sometimes it's hard if you're getting training or education from somebody who's not the actual trainer who does the theatrics of the training. So making sure you do that and have, like I said, those check-ins, having those one-on-ones, setting with agents that are what we call influencers, so that they can influence the work that you want to see that new hire do.
It's been my belief, I mean, I guess learning the hard way at times, that even though the resources, you know, I don't have all this extra time and money to put toward training, it really does pay off because you have good training in the beginning. In fact, you know, even with employee engagement, if onboarding is done effectively and smoothly, you'll have far better engagement than you will if it's not. I mean, if you have this terrible training in the beginning, let alone stick worthiness, people aren't going to hang out in the first place. I like that. And David, you mentioned, you were talking about vision, referring to Shrika or Jennifer. So now I don't know who brought it up for initially, but one of the things
that, comment, really helps, right? That they brought up.
One of the things I think that helps the stick-to-itness is understanding how what you're doing and your silo of activities and tasks affects everybody else. because not just as it goes to the vision, but if you understand practically how what you do impacts someone else, you can begin to understand the importance of what you do and maybe tasks that you don't like. The best example I can think of that we've had, again, I had to learn the hard way, is changing the specific codes on an account from, let's say, you know, in my world, it's litigation. So from it being actively engaged in courts to it being settled and closed.
Yes.
Well, you know, the person who settles it doesn't close it. Well, now we're running reports, but the person who's settling it or closing it or whatever is in, they're not the one running the report for the client. So they don't give a shit about that. They don't think about it. They're never taught where does this information go and how is it used. They're not really going to care enough to do it. But if they understand that, well, we need that, because if we don't, when the client's asking for these reports and the ops manager is running reports, they're going to be wrong. And the client's going to, you know, have negative communications and all this stuff. But then they need to understand that they'll be, you know, it's like once you understand, like a kid. When a kid understands better why you want them to do something, oftentimes you've got a better likelihood of having your kid listen. And I think employees are the same way in, you know, in that respect, that they're more willing to comply with the standards if they understand why those standards exist in the first place.
Love that. Absolutely love that. You know, it's the why behind it, right? And that's something that we could easily deliver. And it should be a component of our delivery, right? That whenever we're talking about training, we should be tying it into the bigger picture of, you know, of why we're asking. We have certain requests and certain asks. You know, I want to talk, if you guys don't mind, just a little bit about when we talk the investments, right? Like, what types of investments should organizations be making into training? Because, you know, I mean, training, as we know, unless you're selling courses, right? Training doesn't make a whole lot of money. So many organizations, training doesn't make any money, right? It's just all cost. But, you know, when we talk about where companies are making their investments, one of the things that I think we did a little pre questions about all of this was, how should leaders determine what absolutely must be retained versus what we can, versus what can be referenced in scripts, tools, or workflows? And how do you want to build training around that distinction? So how would we go about determining what must absolutely be trained versus those things that could just be put into scripts and put into workflows? What's the best way to determine that as, you know, organization or as training industry?
I'll say if the collector must remember it instantly while they're stressed on a live call, that means that they need to truly know it and not look it up, right? So things like compliance rules and how to control the call, empathy, things like that should be, you know, second nature. Everything else can be written down in scripts or tools, so training can focus on how to think and respond, not trying to memorize everything. So, you know, those hardcore things like compliance rules and how to control the call, to me, are things that are absolutely important.
It's like the difference between, you know, the essential of building habits, so you don't have to remember things. So you stay in good habits of knowing how to control the call. I like that answer. What first came to mind when with this question is, I want my folks to understand the overall concepts of what they're doing. Because if they understand the overall goal, like for a collector, you know, they understand the overall goal of the call, and that they understand the overall, you know, they understand kind of our business philosophy of empathy and that kind of thing, but also understand the at least the general concepts of our types of cases. So they have to remember all the nitty gritty, and they're going to have to look at things while maybe somebody's talking rapidly in their ear and they're trying to figure out, you know, what's going on with this case. But if they just understand the basics, I think it'll really help them manage the situation a lot better, even if they can't recall or don't have a script for that exact thing.
I agree.
And once they understand the concepts too, once they're doing it on their own and they're doing it hundreds of times a day over many, many phone calls and many, many right party contacts, it takes maybe a month or two to really understand the everyday conversations you're having and understand, this is my talk off here. This is what works really well for me and those around me. And this is what my company wants me to say. This is the truth. This is, you know, what we need to say for compliance reasons. The repetition and the experience is where that stuff really starts to stick. And so that's kind of another part I want to emphasize about how making sure collection training sticks. Your trainer actually has to be there every day, and they actually have to be practicing and doing everything that they're being asked to do. To Dennis's point, smaller companies that don't have a lot of resources, you're relying on this person shadowing this person. If that's the route that you have to take, that route should not be taken for the long term. You know, classroom study, that's meant for short-term study and then rapid execution. Just because you're having somebody shadow somebody and you're not learning in a classroom does not mean that that timeline should increase or be changed at all. If anything, if you're not in a classroom with someone who knows how to train people on material, you should be starting hands-on training even earlier so that the correct habits and the correct things that your company wants to happen are reinforced early on instead of watching somebody who might be inconsistent or who is not an actual trainer.
Good.
Love that.
I had a question here about measurement of accountability. Great question about, you know, how do we do that? How do we provide the support education training on a low budget, especially?
That's a good question in the chat. It is.
Julie, good job.
Yeah, attendance is, I think it's safe to say that across multiple industries, we are all plagued with attendance issues. The work ethic, I think, of today's workforce is just maybe a little bit different than what it was, you know, years gone by. And with the dawn of, you know, work from home, and we had that big pandemic that shook a lot of things up that many companies are still trying to recover from. You know, I don't know how an individual ends up being late for work and then just, I'll have this just kind of roll out of the bed and turn the computer on, you know. But I will say that from an accountability standpoint, I believe, you know, people reproduce what they see produced. And so as leaders, particularly leaders of that classroom, the trainer is literally that employee's first supervisor. Because if the construct of that company where that trainer works, if the company allows them to provide feedback and coaching and then to make recommendations on performance improvement plans, or even make recommendations on separation of employment, then that trainer is invested with all the responsibilities and duties that a normal supervisor would have. The trainer just has them for a shorter period of time. So what accountability does the trainer have on positively impacting how employees show up? I would take that beyond just with attendance, but how they show up as world-class performing employees. I would say the trainers should be modeling that, right? So if the requirement is that you be on camera, I should be on camera. If the requirement is that you be here 10 minutes before your shift starts so that you can pull up all of your systems as a trainer, I should never be late, because I lose credibility. I lose the ability to speak to any of those types of situations that I'm not holding myself accountable to. So it starts, I think, with that from a practical standpoint. But then also, in order to help them from an accountability standpoint, as training, as the leaders of training, and this isn't necessarily the trainer's responsibility, but as the leaders of training, we should be implementing processes that the trainers and the trainees can easily follow. So processes, right? Like what happens at 15 minutes before the class starts? What happens at the start of class? Are there any communications that get kicked off if someone is or isn't present, right? What do we do? And when we can formulate what we do into a process, then if something goes wrong and someone doesn't show or someone has an attendance issue, we can look back to the process and determine where the breakdown happened. And so either the trainer is following the process, or Maybe the process is just broken and we need to change the process in order to create a greater level of accountability for new hires who are in training. So if there's an attendance policy in place and you do this, you do this, you do this, once employee reaches this, right? They've missed, I don't know, 6 hours worth of training. Then you engage your HR team or HR journalist, I don't know, right? Whatever the process may be. So if those things happen and the individual is absent, and the process is the trainer should send an email and a text message. And if the trainer doesn't send the email and the text message, the process is good. It's just that we're not following the process. So we have no right to expect there to be a great level of accountability and success in that area. But if there's a process in place, we could easily look back and say, okay, we followed the process, but we still have an attendance issue. Or we followed the process, you know, and, you know, the attendance is trending in the right direction. The process is effectively helping that. So I think accountability can be very practical, how I show up, and then it should be built into the business from a process standpoint so that no matter who's training the class, the process protects the business.
David Lee, you're a tough act to follow, so I'm going to need you to go last, okay? you sum it all up for us, and it's hard to go behind you, but everything that you said is wonderful. It just sets the tone for everything else. I would say, you know, always we set a standard. The standard is because we do have a lot of people that we hire remotely, right? And then we have people that we hire who actually come into the building. Well, the standard is set first by HR recruiting by sending the attendants there. Then we send the attendants, or the director actually has a meeting and the managers have a meeting with them before they even begin training. And they set that expectation, a standard of what attendance should be like in training, because it changes for us after they get out of training, right, for new hires. And then as trainers, day one, we have to set that expectation as well. And like you said, we have to be accountable to holding to that expectation. So I'm probably that one that's the thumper out of the trainers. And I'm the one that's like, listen, it's past 15 minutes and I'm into the manager's track. Where is such and such? I mean, I know they're probably tired of hearing from me and I feel like I'm the thumper, but it is what it is, because it's critical that they get this information, right? In order to release them to ops to do their job. So I'm that thumper to make sure that, like you said, the trainer has to ensure that they're upholding whatever that policy is. And you're right. The company does have to have a standard procedure in place and uphold that procedure to ensure that everybody's getting trained the way they should be trained, and there's not interruptions, because everybody knows how it is when you have that new hire that always has issues and problems and can't get to work or is not here. It's hard to train them, and it's hard on the trainers to have to make time to get them caught up. So thank you for paving the way with that, David Lee.
Hey, we're building the city here. I love it.
I will say with accountability, you know, the first thing I do when somebody makes a mistake, I think, okay, were they set up for success? Did they get the training they were supposed to get? Because if they didn't, that's not their fault. That's our fault. Or as the owner of the company, it's my fault. So accountability then is more on me than on that employee. So you do objective measurements as much as you can, but you also, especially when they're new, looking to see if they're understanding, are they getting it, are they a good fit for the culture? You know, and I'm a former HR guy, and an HR phrase is you hire slow and you fire fast.
Wow.
And by that I mean, if you know this person's not a good fit, then for your sake and for their sake, you say, you know what, we've looked at this, you're not a good fit for us. And it's a hard conversation, and it sucks, and doesn't, thankfully it hasn't happened a lot, but everybody knows at least one example, if you've been in business for a long time, of a person that you knew should have been terminated pretty soon, and then you let it go, and then they commit some huge problem, and you're like, oh my gosh, I could have avoided all that by terminating them, holding them ultimately accountable. But I would say before the accountability button is pushed on the employee, the accountability button on yourself needs to be pushed and say, okay, did I do what I was supposed to do? Because especially a small company, I mean, like mine, you know, I don't have the special classes they all go to. And so I think, okay, were they deprived the chance of succeeding in the first place?
Yeah. 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 You know, we got just a few minutes. Can we tackle this one when we talk about training resources? You know, training resources. If you had to advise an operation to shift training resources from one area to another to maximize stickiness, you mean like less classroom time or more technology and tools, where would you recommend they reinvest their time and budget for the greatest long-term impact on collective performance? How would we recommend that a company spends its money and its time if we were asking them to shift resources to have a greater impact on making training more sticky?
Wow, that's a good question. I will only say, I would say live practice and simulations, and buying tools that are embedded in the workflow, because the more they get that live practice and that hands-on, the better it sticks for them. I would say we use this thing called a tool, not thing, called Balto, where it's like a two-way conversation. So it listens to our agent, and as well as it listens to the patient, and it pulls up. It gives you rebuttal. So if they give you a rebuttal, it'll pull up a rebuttal. It gives you all your scripts. It gives you everything in a call summary afterwards. So you can have, correct summary of what happened on the phone call. So I would say invest in tools that can provide you with live simulations of what they're going to actually encounter on the phone call, live practices and anything that you can embed in your workflow to make it go smoother.
I like
I
that.
agree. And the real basic part of that, I think everyone should invest more time in that might be kind of skipped over, is repetition and review. Making sure that it's not just done once in the morning or once at the end of the day. It's done literally like every hour, or literally like after every new thing that's learned to make sure that it's what you're saying has been reinforced and it's reinforced correctly. And then like pop quizzes like we used to do in school where you're just like, hey, I'm just testing you that, tell me what you would do in this situation. I think that is a great free thing that trainers could do more of that would help reinforce things and make things stick.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. You know, I think we all could agree that technology is, and for most companies, it's going to be the one place where the company is going to make its biggest investment, right? We absolutely have to keep pace with the times, right? And if we're technologically inferior to the competitors, it puts our employees at a disadvantage. I don't care who's in the classroom, right? You can have the world's greatest trainer in that classroom. If the technology that the trainer is utilizing to equip the employees is, you know, if it isn't where it needs to be, or if the technologies that the employees are going to utilize out on the floor isn't where it needs to be, right? All of those things can really hamper stickiness and long-term performance. And so these aren't easy questions to answer, but I think that companies, it's beholden to them to take a look at long-term, you know, how we secure the resources in order to make those kinds of investments, the technological investments. There's a lot being done with AI. There are some other tools out there like Articulate Storyline, Camtasia. And I think that as we incorporate all of those different types of multimodal, right, learning tools so that we can appeal to the different learning styles that show up in the classrooms, right? I think that that just makes us better as you know, organizations, and makes our training more sticky. So I don't think it's wise to put 100% of the effectiveness on the training on the trainer. I think we need to provide them with the tools and the technology that undergirds and supports the trainer, right? So that whether if the trainer isn't as effective or it has an off day, well, that technology essentially makes up the gap as the trainer is building that skill set, right? So I think technology is a really good place to make the investment. Maybe an LMS system, right? Talent LMS is a great one if you got a ton of money. Litmos is an even better one, right? You know.
Agreeing.
Tell you what, though, I agree with everything you said, but Sharika, you mentioned some real life simulations. A quotation that gets thrown around a lot by Mike Gibb, everybody has a plan, or it's by Mike Tyson, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the face, right? So technology and scripting is all good and fine, but until you get on that call and you're actually talking to a consumer, it's all theoretical, and that's where you really get to learn. And so better feedback and training doing that is a good thing. Now, again, I agree with all the technology and all that stuff, but nothing substitutes the real life experience.
Practical. Yeah, I hear you.
See, my thing is everybody has willpower until a piece of pizza gets waved in front of my face. Completely different situation. We are almost out of time, so I will wrap up. But first, David Lee was nice enough to mention technology, which gives me an entryway to plug ArmTech, which is coming up next month in Dallas. ArmTech.live is the website, the industry's only event exclusively dedicated to talking about technology. 26 hours of content, all dedicated to data analytics and artificial intelligence and digital communications and everything that's going into technology and all the investments that are being made. It's a great opportunity to learn, to interact, to engage with other like-minded professionals who care about being more efficient, more effective. If you haven't been there, I can put you in touch with people who have. They have great reviews, great testimonials. Would love to see you in Dallas next month at the conference.
It's a great conference.
Thank you. See, there it is. Love it. Appreciate that. So Dennis, David Lee, Jennifer, Sharika, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedules to be here today. On behalf of everybody who's watching and listening, a ton of great information, useful information, actionable information, things that people can actually do as soon as this webinar is over. So I really appreciate each of you taking time and being here to share your perspectives today. So thanks for that. Chris, you at Peak Revenue Learning, thank you so much for sponsoring today's webinar. Everybody, please check them out, peakrevenuelearning.com. All of you watching and listening, thank you so much for making us part of your day. We really appreciate it. If you're watching us live, we're taking all this stuff we talked about today about how to make collector training stick, and we're talking about the most important component of any collection interaction, and that's the first 30 seconds, how to make the first 30 seconds of every interaction you have with a consumer count and engaging. If you haven't signed up for that yet, there is a link in the chat, or you can find a link on the events calendar at accountrecovery.net. Hopefully, we'd love to see you back for that tomorrow at 1 o'clock Eastern. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day, everybody. Thank you so much for being here, and we look forward to seeing everybody soon. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Thanks.